Please pick up a sheet of paper and then write down your question. And until then, if anyone has a question to be asked on the microphone, I'll bring the mic.
This is one of the also one of the precedents established by the Buddha at the Parinibbana, and he said, anybody want any questions before I pass away? Anything that you haven't learned? Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Yeah, imagine that you're just dying and still all you're concerned about is to help people. And then so compassionate, he says, well, if you're nervous to ask, then let a friend ask a friend. So we say the same thing here. If you're nervous to ask at the microphone, then you can write it down on a slip of paper.
Until the questions become ready, may I ask you one question, Ajahn? Can you hear me? The various schools of Buddhism, Theravada and Mahayana and Vajrayana, etc., what does the sutra say about how they originated? Does it say anything about the various schools of Buddhism, please? And
okay.
Especially in the context of Theravada, yes, in Sri Lanka we
okay.
practice.
So the question is, what about the different schools of Buddhism? Well, this is another long, complicated topic. I wrote a book about it called Sects and Sectarianism. So you're most welcome to get a hold of that and have a look. But essentially, of course, you don't find any schools of Buddhism in the time of the Buddha, right? So this is another thing that people do after the Buddha passes away, right? And the Buddha didn't teach Theravada. He didn't teach... In fact, the word Theravada is only used in the early suttas to refer to the teachings of Alarika Lama and Uddhaka Ramaputta, right? Not even a Buddha's teachings. So the Buddha didn't teach Mahayana or Vajrayana or anything like that. He taught the Dhamma. So, of course, what happens after is that there's always a tendency to split off, to disintegrate into different groups. And so there was that tendency to some degree within the Buddha's lifetime. You know, you saw that the sutta specialists would go and become Ananda's students, and the Vinaya specialists would become Upali students, and the ones who are interested in psychic powers would go and practice with Venerable Moggallana, and so on and so forth. So there was already that, you know, difference in orientation and specialization among the Sangha. But there wasn't any schools of Buddhism then, and not until quite some time later. The scholars differ in their accounts of how the schools originated. And when I went back and reviewed these all a few years ago, I thought I didn't agree with any of them. I thought they all were wrong. So I made my own research on that, which I put in my book, Sects and Sectarianism. But my account is essentially this, and this will be different from the accounts that you've heard by other people. So anyway, you can make up your own mind, but this is just my conclusions. That the origins of the Buddhist schools, the main origins happened in the time of King Ashoka and after King Ashoka, when missionaries were sent out to different parts of India to spread the Dhamma. And the most reliable historical account of that, it seems to me, is in the Vinaya commentary, the Samantabhasarika, which exists both in a Pali version and also a Chinese version. This Chinese version was translated from a Sinhalese text in about 400-something AD, taken to China by Fasien from Sri Lanka. And they give essentially the same account, which is that in the time of King Ashoka, that a number of Dhamma teachers were sent out to different parts of India. Now, of course, as this is a Sri Lankan account, it's most interested in the story of Venerable Mahinda and Sanghamitta bringing the Dhamma to Sri Lanka. But they also mention briefly Dhamma missionaries sent out to many other places, to Kashmir, Gandhara, Suvarnabhumi, Mahisha, and various other places. And it seems to me this is a very plausible account that in the time of King Ashoka, Dhamma is spreading very widely, the great teachers are sent out to different parts of India, and that slowly, of course, that the different schools would evolve from that. So the primary cause is just geographical separation. You know, there's some monks are sent to Kashmir and some to Sri Lanka. Well, it's a long way from Kashmir to Sri Lanka, yeah? And gradually they would grow apart, yeah? And that's a very kind of natural process. So it seems to me that most of the differences between the schools it comes from that kind of gradual separation. However, in addition to that, there was also a split on some doctrinal grounds, and the earliest such split was that between what we call the Stavira school and the Mahasanghika school. And that was on a question of the five five points of difference, most of which concerned the status of the arahant. So in that case, there was a genuine difference that these schools split upon. From there, we had 18 schools, a number of schools in the Theravadin group of schools, and a number of schools in the Mahasanghika group of schools. And currently, the only one of those schools that still exists as such is, of course, the Theravada in Sri Lanka. Over time, those schools developed, and another movement arose, could we call the Mahayana. Now, in India, for a long time, the Mahayana was never a separate school of Buddhism, okay? So all of the evidence shows that for many years, many hundreds of years in India, that the Mahayanist monks and nuns would be staying in the same monasteries and practicing the same way, keeping the same vinaya and doing all the same things, but they would develop their own philosophies and their own interpretations, which were in some ways developed from the early Buddhist teachings. So it wasn't really so much of as a different school to begin with as a different approach to practice and understanding the Dhamma. However, when Dhamma went to China and then much later to Tibet, the Mahayana became immediately very popular, and it became very much the overwhelming kind of dominant school. So this is why we find today that in China and Tibet, the kinds of Buddhism there is the Mahayana Buddhism. But remember, I said that in India they were always living in the same monasteries, so the monastic discipline, the monastic codes, the vinaya, is still essentially the same. And this is what we find when we investigate the various vinayas that exist today. There are many different vinaya texts in Buddhism, and I've just compiled a list of vinaya rules in the different traditions, the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis rules and the different texts in all the different traditions, and I found no less than 45 sets of vinaya rules in the different traditions, which counts up to about 14,000 rules. Yeah, so that's quite a lot of rules, and most of them are always the same in the bhikkhu and the bhikkhuni vinaya across all of the different traditions. There's a few small differences, but not many. So the Mahayana, it's important to understand, just to repeat, is a philosophical and a practice movement, but not doesn't change the vinaya basis of the monastic practice. Okay.
Can I speak?
Do we have any questions? Bhikkhuni Kusuma.
Is this okay? Okay. Venerable sir, is it possible for us to separate out the original Buddha word from tradition and myth and history? That could be very useful, because we can go at it without all the embellishments.
Yes, yes.
So we invite you to do that.
You want me to do it? Well, why don't you do it? Is it possible? Yes, it's possible to some degree, and lots of people have done this. You know, it's not just, you know, it's not just now. I mean, it's the whole, you know, Buddhist modernist movement, starting with Rhys Davids, and many people during even the 19th century. We find reformers, whether in the Thai forest tradition, you know, going back to a more authentic practice of meditation. We find the Burmese Vipassana movement, Mahasi Sayadaw and so on, also trying to come back to the early Buddhist teachings. We find in somewhere like Vietnam, someone like Thich Nhat Hanh, who's again trying to come back in his way, a different way again, to his understanding of early Buddhism and emphasizing a much closer connection with you know, Theravada practices like Anapanasati and so on. We find in Taiwan, one of the greatest Taiwanese or Chinese modern masters of Buddhism is Master Yin Shun, who passed away a few years ago now, at just over 100 years. And he was very profoundly revered in Taiwan, and had over 1 million followers there. And Master Yin Shun, more and more in his life, came to see Buddhism through the lens of early Buddhism and through seeing the essential harmony of the Pali Nikayas and the Chinese Agamas. Again, we find similar things with, say, the Dalai Lama. And I, one very interesting. Dalai Lama says some amazing things, really. I mean, one interesting thing that he said, just a sort of just a remark, and almost an offhand remark. He said in our tradition, our Tibetan tradition, you know, we teach a lot of these mantras and visualizations and purification practices and so on. And he says, you know, sometimes I really wonder about all of these things and what we're doing with these things. But he said the things that I can really say that I've seen are beneficial for myself and for others, and that I can wholeheartedly recommend is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the practice of compassion. And you know, so I think what I've always found in my Dhamma practice is that every tradition of Buddhism, the Dhamma is there, right? And it's up to the wisdom and the insight of the teachers to be able to find what is that Dhamma and to be able to express that. And so I think everywhere we go, we can find that. And it's certainly, you know, so this is why the thing that I really love is to not emphasize the difference between these traditions, but always look at what is held in common. And when we come back to what is held in common between the traditions, we tend to find, what's held in common is the Four Noble Truths. What's held in common is the Eightfold Noble Path. What's held in common is the practice of Sila Samadhi Panya, the dependent origination, the Anicca Dukkha Anatta, the five spiritual faculties, the seven awakening factors, all of these central Dhamma teachings that we find in the suttas again and again and again, and these are repeated across all of these different traditions in exactly the same way. And often we find just a very, very tiny differences. You know, I was researching years ago on the Satipatthana Sutta, and I discovered that there was actually a version of the Satipatthana Sutta buried deep in the Prajnaparamita Sutta. Prajnaparamita is one of the classic Mahayana sutras, and you know, many, many sort of elaborations and so on it gives. And then right in the middle of it, there's this passage where it says, you know, in the Pali Satipatthana Sutra, it says, here a bhikkhu goes forth and goes back and acts with clear comprehension, and bending and stretching the limbs, they act with clear comprehension and so on. And then here in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, it says, here a bodhisattva going backwards and forwards, he acts with clear comprehension. When bending and stretching the limbs, acts with clear comprehension, and so on and so forth. It's exactly the same, except it says a bodhisattva instead of a bhikkhu. And so, to me, it's always very, very beautiful when I recognize these core teachings, because what it reminds me of is what a good job the Sangha did to put together and to preserve the teachings in a way that would still have relevance and power throughout the ages. So to me, this is if we're going to come back, what is the real Buddha's teachings, then this is the most powerful way we can do it. Two things. One is practice, and the second thing is to investigate what are the teachings common to all the Buddha's traditions. Okay.
Greetings, Venerable. I have a question for you before you read that paper.
Yes.
One small question.
Please.
It was an honor to be here, and I have a question. One small teenager watched a movie, Sri Siddhartha Gautama. She was a Christian. After watching the movie, we were just sitting all together, and she told us that after watching the movie, she wanted to convert herself as a Buddhist. So our people told her, then, but her parents didn't allow her. She went to her parents that I want to be a Buddhist. They said, no, it's not possible. Then one of our friend told her that you don't need to change your religion, but better if you follow the path, what he's teaching, you'll be a better Christian once you follow the path. This was the answer. But when we shared this question and answer with one of our teachers, he said, it was totally wrong, because I'm also learning Buddhism. I don't know much about it. Was it a wrong answer or was it a right answer? I don't know what we told that girl was right or wrong. We need to know what was that.
Well, in the thank you for that question. This is a very important one, and it's something which comes up for me quite a lot in Australia. Just come back straight to the suttas. Udumbarika Sihanada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. I can give you the reference to it later on if you want. You can check it out for yourself, see whether I've represented it correctly. But the Buddha is teaching a wanderer, and he says to him, you might think that I'm teaching in order to gain converts, But do not think so. I do not teach in order to gain converts. You might think that I want you to abandon your former teacher. Do not think so. Let your teacher remain your teacher. You might think that I'm teaching you in order to make you give up your religious practices. Do not think so. Let your practices remain your practices. Yeah? I'm only teaching you in order to help you to let go of suffering. That's the only purpose. Yeah? So that's straight out of the suttas. Yeah. So I think this is very, very important to remember. The Dalai Lama, again, has said this many times. You know, don't convert to become Buddhist. Just be a better person. Practice the Dhamma. And the Buddha never went around telling anybody to become Buddhist or anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, when we had cases in suttas, another case when Siha, the general, right? He's a general. He's an important man. He came to the, and he was a follower of the Jains. And he came to the Buddha and heard some teachings and wanted to convert to become a Buddhist and to follow the Buddha. And the Buddha said to him, just wait, be careful, you know, think about it first. You know, you're a well-known man, people will pay attention to what you're doing and you've been supporting the Jains, you know. So just don't rush into any decision. And then he said to the Buddha, now I have even more faith in you now. I now even more want to become converted. Yeah? And the Buddha said, well, look, if you want to take refuge, that's fine, but you should still keep giving alms to the Jains. Yeah? Don't stop giving alms to the Jains. Yeah? So very, you know, these, and that's not paraphrasing or anything, that's straight out of the suttas. And so, you know, we find these kinds of examples. I had an interesting case that happened to me in Sydney a couple of years ago. I had one Sri Lankan girl come to see me. She was a university student, and she was brought up in a Buddhist family, and she wanted to become Christian, or she had become Christian. That's like the opposite story. Now, why anybody would want to do that, I don't know. But anyway, this is what she said. Actually, you know, that was I shouldn't have said that. I do know why she wanted to become Christian. She wanted to become Christian because she was at university, and she felt a sense of fellowship and community there from the Christian groups that she hadn't found within a Buddhist community. Simple as that. She found a really nice pastor in her area who was really good, and they were having a great community, and she really agreed with the values they were doing and the things they were doing and felt at home there. So for her it was just natural. She wasn't being critical of Buddhism or anything like that. It's just that was where her heart lay. That was where her path was. And so she had like a, you know, a Bible at her home and these kinds of things, and her parents searched through her room and took the Bible and threw it in the rubbish bin. And these kinds of things. So that was obviously a bit of tension going on there. And so she comes to me and says, you know, what should I do, Bhante? So I went and spoke with her pastor about this, and we had this kind of discussion. He was a very nice guy, and you know, they were doing good things there. So I said, look, I don't have a problem with it. If you know you're finding your happiness, you need to find your happiness in your path, and you can't constrain that, you can't determine that. And I can honestly say from my own experience, you know, at that age, people need to be free. You can't force somebody to be a Buddhist. If somebody wants to follow their heart, you let them follow their heart. Who knows what will happen? Yeah, maybe later on they'll return to the Buddhism, or maybe not. Who knows? But if you're turning the Dhamma from being something that is solely there to help people overcome suffering, then how could you not support her? She was clearly suffering less by following that path. I mean, it's obvious, right? She was suffering a lot by being forced to deny her faith and to pretend that she didn't really believe in Christianity. Huh? And she felt much less suffering when she was able to practice that what she believed in. So to me, this wasn't even a question. This was very, very straightforward. Yeah. It, you know, I researched a couple of years ago how many Buddhists there are in the world. It's a curiously difficult question to answer. And the estimates of the number of Buddhists in the world range between 300 million and about 1.2 billion. Okay? So that's a margin of error of about 900 million people who aren't quite sure if they're Buddhists or not. Okay? Now, obviously, most of those is probably in China, I would guess. But still, I think that captures something which is quite important about the Buddhist tradition, you know, that our identity as Buddhists is not the crucial thing. And I know in Sri Lanka, I've been told by so many people that, you know, you'll come along to the temple and worship at the temple and so on, and then you'll go down to the Hindu shrine and do some offerings and worship at the Hindu shrine and so on as well. And you find similar things in Thailand and similar things in Burma, and every Buddhist country you find similar kinds of things, yeah? And it's okay, it's all right. You know, you can go and make some offerings at the Hindu shrine. The only thing the Buddha said, well, look, just don't do anything that's going to be harmful. You know, if you're going to go sacrifice some animals or something, you shouldn't do it. But you want to go and offer some rice and ghee and do some mantras or something, you're not hurting anybody. So the important thing always is, what is the practice of Dhamma? Okay. Could you briefly explain how to practice, how to attain the paths and the fruits, the process? My goodness. Briefly? Well, you practice the Eightfold Path, and that's how you do it. I can't talk about that too much now, but the only thing that I would say is that just to remember that the Eightfold Path, all the other practices that the Buddha taught, are very holistic practices. There's no one secret. There's no, there's not just one practice to do. There's no magic trick. People sometimes look for a shortcut. They say, you want a shortcut? There is a shortcut. It's called the Eightfold Path, okay? That's the shortest of shortcuts, right? The Buddha didn't teach you the Eightfold Path because he wanted you to stay in samsara for longer, okay? He taught that because that's the fastest way to realize the Dhamma, okay? Okay, so next question. Is it possible that the concepts of rebirth and karma were introduced into Buddhism after the Buddha's passing away to transform Buddhism from being a philosophy into a religion like Hinduism? Ooh, okay. Now, well, this is a view which you hear expressed quite frequently, and so it deserves a clear response. Okay. Okay. First part of the question: is it possible? So the answer to that is yes, it's possible. I don't know if you want me to go any further, but of course it's possible, right? Is it likely? No, not particularly, but it's possible, right? Just to comment briefly on the couple of points in the question here before going on to answer the substance of it more, but it says to transform Buddhism from a philosophy into a religion. Both of these words, I think, are equally inadequate to describe really what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is a way to liberation. It's not just a philosophy is something you sit around and chat. I mean, if you look in the Greek philosophers, you know, they would kind of sit around at the dinner table and discuss about the nature of truth and love and so on while they were drinking wine. And that's not really what Buddhism is about, right? And sort of the seriousness of the conversation in the Socratic dialogues is determined by the proportions that the wine is mixed with the water, right? So that's how to get the conversation flowing. So I think Buddhism is I think neither really a religion in our conventional sense nor just a philosophy. Of course, conventionally, we have to say that Buddhism is a religion, mainly for tax purposes. Okay. Again, to make a point about Hinduism, if you want to understand ancient Indian history, the starting point you have to make is Hinduism did not exist in the time of the Buddha. Okay? Simple as that. The idea that Hinduism existed in the time of the Buddha is a delusion which was propagated in the 19th century by Hindu pundits and which was thoroughly discredited and dismissed by the early generation of Indologists, especially Thomas Rhys-Davids and others, and which has had zero traction or plausibility in any reputable academic or scholarly research since that time. Okay. Hinduism didn't exist, right? So what do I mean when I say Hinduism didn't exist? Well, if we compare with the say the Western tradition, you can say in say the time of Abraham or Moses or something like that, you could say, was Moses a Catholic? Right? Well, obviously not. Catholicism didn't exist in the time of Moses, right? There was a continuity of tradition, right? So the Hebrew tradition evolved into something which one form of which became Catholicism. So there's not completely disconnected. But to say that Moses was a Catholic is completely absurd. In the same way, to say that people in the time of the Buddha were Hindus is just absurd. There was no Shiva. There was no Vishnu. There was no Skanda. There was no Ganesh. There was no Krishna. There was no temples. There was no Ramayana or Mahabharata. There was all of these things which we think of as being so important in Hinduism simply didn't exist, okay? What existed was a Vedic tradition, a Brahmanical tradition. The Vedas were there. There were certain ritual practices and so on. These were done in different ways in different places. And in many cases, they weren't yet unified into one overall system. So that the meditative practices done over there and the philosophical practices done here and the rituals done there were all just different religious spiritual practices, which today we might say were Hinduism, but at the time were not seen as being part of the same thing, right? They were just different practices that different people did. And it wasn't until about the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries that the great Hindu scholars and philosophers, primarily Shankara and others, came and unified all of that and brought it under one umbrella and called it Hinduism. Okay, so if we want to understand history at the time of the Buddha, one of the basic facts we have to really get through is Hinduism didn't exist. Brahmanism existed, Vedism existed, but it wasn't the same as the modern Hinduism. It evolved into the modern Hinduism, but it wasn't the same as it. Okay, so then the question, is it possible that Buddhism adopted the notion of karma and rebirth? Well, one of the reasons why people find this idea to be very plausible is because in modern India, basically, all of the different religions' traditions teach about karma and rebirth. Okay, almost all the Hindu traditions believe in that, the Jaina traditions do, and so on. So it seems inconceivable to us that Indian religious people would not believe in karma and rebirth. Right? However, that was not the case in the time of the Buddha. Okay, in the time of the Buddha, we had a very diverse religious scene. And many of the people, perhaps the majority, did not believe in karma and rebirth. Okay. Now, in some cases, this was explicitly stated, and we have the teachings of many of the ascetics in the time of the Buddha, the Shramanas, who rejected explicitly the notion of karma and rebirth and said that all there is this life, and this body is made up of the four elements, and when it dies, it just disappears, and that's all there is to it. Okay. So these ideas were quite prominent and clear. It wasn't as if just everybody believed in karma and rebirth. Even within the Brahmanical tradition, the notion of karma and rebirth seems to have been very unclear at that time. It's mentioned occasionally in some of the Upanishads, which come up before the Buddha, but hardly at all in the Vedas, and it certainly wasn't a prominent part of the Brahmanical tradition. And in fact, rather than Buddhism being influenced by Hinduism, it seems much more likely that it was the other way around, that the Buddhist teaching was the first teaching in ancient India to really put the teaching of karma and rebirth on center stage, together with Jainism around the same time. And later on, that became the accepted philosophy within most strands of Hinduism as well. But at the time of the Buddha, that wasn't the case. So when we look at the Buddha's own sutta's statements on karma and rebirth, they are completely embedded right within the core structures of the Dhamma. Right? I mean, look at the Four Noble Truths. Jatipi dukkha, jarapi dukkha, maranampi dukkha. It's talking about rebirth. Yeah? In the Second Noble Truth, yayang tanha pono bhavika. Yeah? That craving that leads to future rebirth. That's what pono bhava means. Yeah? It literally means rebirth, doesn't mean anything else. So the idea of rebirth is not something which is grafted onto the Dhamma, and it's not something which the Buddha just inherited. You know, there's this phrase in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu, with regard to Dhammas that were not learnt from another, anusutta, ananusutta, not learnt from somebody else, okay? And the Buddha actually explicitly states this many times, that this teaching of karma and rebirth is not something that he's learnt from any other Samana and Brahmana. It's something that he teaches because of his own direct insight. and he speaks many, many times about the direct insight and direct recollection of past lives and the divine eye and so on and so forth. Okay, so the answer to that question then is that it's not, is it possible that this was grafted onto Buddhism at a later date? It's possible, anything's possible. Is it likely? No. I think the overwhelming evidence is that it may well have been an idea that was current among some teachers at the time of the Buddha, but the Buddha used his discernment in what he would adopt and what he wouldn't adopt. Yeah? And this is something. Sometimes people have these very strange ideas. They think that if something was current in the culture, therefore the Buddha just blindly repeated it like a parrot. I find this just so ridiculous. You and I learnt while we were at school, and many people would have learnt whilst here at Royal College, how to distinguish between what's true and what's not true, how to inquire into what is a fact and what isn't a fact. And this is a basic thing that we learn when we're teenagers. And somehow people say that the Buddha was not capable of reflecting and inquiring as to what was true and what wasn't true. And this, of course, I find to be the least plausible interpretation of the Buddha's acts that's possible. Okay, next one. Okay, so this is irrelevant. It's either irrelevant or irreverent. I guess it's irrelevant in today's discussion. There seems to be so many questions in life that don't have answers. Yes, questions like what life really is. Why people say it's better to be alive than not to be born, whereas I see it only as a pain and suffering. Oh, that's very sad. Really? Only pain and suffering? Surely there's some good things about life. Has Buddhism got answers for those, or is it simply a waste of time to look for answers? No, I don't think it's a waste of time to look for answers. I think that one of the signs of wisdom is knowing what is the limit of questions. What are the kinds of things that we can expect answers for, and what are the kinds of things that we can't? So ultimately the question that the Buddha set out to answer is why do we suffer? How can we let go of suffering? So if we want to look into Buddhism and find out, you know, the subatomic structure of the universe or something like that, we're not going to find it. Many things that are not found in Buddhism. But what there is found an understanding of the human mind, an understanding of why we suffer and how we can learn to let go of suffering. I have found a lot of answers in Buddhism that I find to be very meaningful for myself. And I know obviously many other people have. But for whoever asked that question, I just want you to know that these kinds of answers are very personal. Maybe we could say that if the Buddha was here, he would be able to answer that question in a way that would satisfy you. Whether in the teachings of Buddha is handed down, whether there's something that's going to satisfy you in that way, I can't say. I can say that it's been very valuable for me and that there's a lot of wisdom there. But don't let yourself be shortchanged by reassurances. Don't let yourself accept too easily answers that people give you, especially if they're glib and easy answers. Yeah? You see the answer I'm giving to this question. I'm not giving you an easy answer. Now, it'd be very easy for me to sit here and say, yes, Buddhism will give you the answer. I don't want to say that. Yeah? I want you to find that answer for yourself. I hope that within the teachings of the Dhamma that you can find some guidance towards that. But in finding that answer is up to you. Okay. Okay, next one. There's a lot of mention of various powers used by arahants. Aha. Arahants were like superheroes flying through the air, faster than a speeding bullet. Even today, about Buddha statues that emit a halo. I've seen Buddha statues without the LED lights and stuff. Is that the... How much of this is myth, and what is possibility of it being realistic? Comment. was relieved to have my doubt confirmed in your version of why Mahapajapati Bhikkhuni's order was according to legend. Yeah. Okay, so I've written and spoken about that topic of Mahapajapati quite a lot. So anyway, it's probably not sure if I have time to talk about that more today. But anyway, Buddha statues that emit a halo. No, I do not believe that Buddha statues emit a halo. Various powers used by arahants. Well, this is something I think the Buddha was a Vibhajjavadin. He would be a teacher of analysis. I think that often you might find that those stories are exaggerated and so on. But there is plenty of evidence that the powers of the mind are truly astonishing. And this is something which, you know, there's just so many things which are so amazing that have been shown and proven and so on and so forth. If anybody's interested to learn something about the what's possible with the mind, to somehow to kind of explode your preconceptions about what may be possible and what isn't possible, then I can't recommend strongly enough a book called Irreducible Mind. You can all note that down, Irreducible Mind. You can go home and Google it and order yourself a copy. It's like a really big, thick book like that with really small printing and lots of dense footnotes, okay? But and so it's not one you're going to sort of casually read on the weekend, but it's great as a reference work. It's got summaries of over 100 years of research into all kinds of weird and wonderful things like telepathy and meditation states and all kinds of things. So if you want to find out and really understand, and this is all based on sort of proper research, it's not anecdotal evidence and so on, then if you want to find out what there is, then look at those things. And then it seems to me that if ordinary people, most of these studies is done just with ordinary people. There's a few that are done with some great sages and so on, but even if ordinary people can experience these extraordinary things, then what can be possible with the experience of enlightenment? I mean, just to give one example from recent times was, I'm sure you probably many of you heard the story of they called him the Buddha boy of Nepal. And it was a very, very amazing story that was about 3 or 4 years ago now. And he just sat under a tree in Nepal in the forest for months, just for months on end, just sitting in one spot. Just sitting. And it was just astonishing. And I remember seeing a documentary about it, and they sort of put a camera on him for a whole week to see if he was cheating and kind of sneaking off and stuff. I mean, most of you have meditated, and you know it's not easy to sit for like 20 minutes without moving, right? I mean, an hour's meditation is most of us can do. We think that's pretty good. But to sit for months on end, and they had this camera on him, filming him and showing that he wasn't moving from that place for all of that time. For I think they put it for a week, the camera, and sort of meme. And they interspersed that with photograph, with interview with this Western doctor who was explaining how this is completely impossible and he couldn't sit there without moving and your body couldn't survive without the water and so on and so forth. And it's completely impossible, while the film is showing it's obviously happening, right? So. Impossible things are possible. We don't know the limits of our knowledge. So as to whether all of those things that we hear the stories, I doubt if all of them are true, but I'm sure that some of them are. Okay, next question. My astrologer says my boyfriend is from a rebirth. All right. His age is 54, I'm 51, and something, we have something marriage? Not sure. Okay, I'm not sure if this is a question actually. Look, I'm not sure if that one's a question, so if whoever asks that has a question, then maybe they can speak to me afterwards. Okay, is there a book which explains what Buddhism is for people from different religions? Oh, that's a very good question. Somebody should write that, right? I don't know, there's a lot of, simple introductions to Buddhism and so on. I know of some books that sort of point to similarities and points of connection between Buddhism and other religions, but I'm not aware of one specifically that's intended to explain Buddhism for people of different religions. Oh, one which comes to mind though is there's a book called Simply Buddha by Karen Armstrong, And she's writing primarily for a non-Buddhist audience, and she gives quite a nice retelling of the Buddha's life story in that. So maybe that might be one example. In the life of the Buddha, was there any reference to gods and supernatural power? This is something that came up when we were watching the film Siddhartha Gautama last night. And in that film, they very carefully avoided any reference or indication of supernatural events and references to gods and things like that. But it is something that we find in the early texts. However, the way that it's presented is quite we have to take with a bit of nuance. It's extremely rare to find the Buddha actually talking with gods. Okay. Yes, once or twice he does, has a conversation with Mara in a few times. But even in the conversations with Mara, often it seems very clear this is meant purely as a metaphor. I mean, we have the 10 armies of Mara is described in the suttas as being like greed and sloth and hatred and anger and so on. So it's clearly meant to be interpreted and understood in a psychological sense. And similarly with the daughters of Mara. It's craving, lechery and greed. You know, again, obviously meant as a metaphor. So even though the references to gods in the terms of the different planes of rebirth and being reborn in different states, that's mentioned a fair amount of times, but actually the intervention of gods into the Buddha's life in a meaningful way, we find happens only very rarely. Similarly with supernatural powers, yes, the Buddha refers to them in teachings, and there's a few examples given when the Buddha is reading somebody's mind or something like that, but they're fairly restrained and fairly rare to find those things in the suttas. Only, you know, I would guess maybe, you know, 5% of suttas or something like that might mention those things. So it's certainly not as if it's very common. Okay. Question here. Did the infant Siddhartha walk immediately when he was born on 7 lotuses? Okay. Well, the 7 lotuses thing is definitely a part of the later tradition. We don't find that in the suttas. The early suttas in the Acharya Bhuta Sutta and also in the Mahapadana Sutta does mention that the Bodhisattva took 7 steps to the north. But it wasn't just 7 steps to the north. It says Satta Paravitihara, which means 7 mighty strides, okay? It's not just a step that he took, it's 7 mighty strides. And then he didn't just speak, he roared out with the voice of a bull, okay? So that must have been quite shocking for the people there, right? Maybe that explains why Maya died 7 days later. Maybe she had a heart attack, I don't know. But even though that passage is found in the early suttas, but it seems to me that it's almost certainly is a later development. To me, the only detail of the birth that really strikes me, or details of the birth that really strike me as authentic, as I mentioned earlier, was the fact that it was on the journey through Lumbini and that the Maya passed away after 7 days. The rest of it I would put up to elaboration. One of the reasons for saying that obviously seems intrinsically a bit implausible, but also there's quite strong differences in that account between the Pali and the Chinese account of that same sutta. So I won't go into too much detail there, but there are text critical reasons also for having some question marks over that particular passage. Okay, so number one, what is the Buddha's message about death and rebirth? I.e., where does the dead person go? I just lost a parent. Well, the Buddha said that rebirth is conditioned by the mind. It's conditioned by our karma, which is the choices that we make. And if we look into our lives and look into our minds are extremely variable. We make different decisions, different choices. And so those different choices can send our minds in different directions. So obviously if somebody's led a good life and on the whole that they've done good things and practiced well for their life, then they'll go to a good destiny. If they've done bad things, then they'll go to a bad destiny. If they've done mixed things, then it's not so certain. You know, even though we worry about that too much, I think, There's one lovely sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya where Mahanama, the Sakyan, comes up to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, you know, Lord, sometimes I am walking along the road and I trip over. And when I trip, I lose my mindfulness. I forget about the Dhamma. And then I get afraid. I think about that and I think, oh, what happens if I was to die now? What happens if I was to pass away while my mindfulness is lost? Where would I go? And the Buddha says to him, Ma bhai mahanama, ma bhai mahanama. Do not fear mahanama, do not fear mahanama. How can it be that somebody who has taken refuge for such a long time, who has kept the precepts for such a long time, who has practiced the Dhamma for such a long time, should go to a bad destiny? It's not possible, it cannot happen. Do not fear, do not fear. Okay. Question two, how did so many Buddhist countries convert to Hinduism, Muslim religion, and Christianity? What made them change? Well, different things, I guess, made people change. It's a complex question, and I don't think there's any one simple answer. I'm trying to think if I can say anything sensible about it. Okay, so we have two separate issues here. One is the issue of the conversion of Buddhist regions in the past. And, of course, if you look at the height of Buddhism, say, around the time of King Kanishka, around 1st century AD, Buddhism stretched from Iran in the west up through the Central Asian regions to China, a bit later on as far as Indonesia. And much of that region is no longer Buddhist, either a Hindu or Muslim. So there were obviously various historical reasons for that. I won't go into that too much now, and the reason because it's a complex question and it's highly uncertain. There's no really good evidence one way or the other for that. So I'll just leave that to one side because it would lead me too far astray to talk about it too much. In modern days, of course, we find quite a problem, I think, in Buddhist countries. At least many Buddhists say to me there's a problem with aggressive attempts at conversion from Christianity. And this is something where I think, personally, I feel that Buddhists are overly concerned about this. I think, yes, there is a genuine problem, especially when the conversion attempts are unethical and people are pressured and manipulated to convert. I think, yes, that's a genuine problem. And I support the initiative that was brought in Sri Lanka a few years ago to pass a law against unethical conversion. I think it was a great thing. I'm not sure where that stands now, whether it eventually got passed or not. But I think we should be principled. If people want to teach their religion and so on, that's fine. But it needs to be done in an ethical way. I don't think that Buddhism faces a problem from conversion. I think that the important thing for Buddhists to bear in mind is just to strengthen the Dhamma. If we're practicing well, if you look at how the Buddha said, what is it for the long lasting of the Dhamma? If the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen are practicing sila, samadhi, panya, if they're respecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and then the sasana will last long. So if we have that internal strength, then we don't need to worry about these kinds of things. So the question that we have to answer is that question that I posed at the beginning of the talk, which is how do we make these teachings vital and real? How do we apply them and make them relevant for our lives? Okay, from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it feels that Venerable Mahakassapa assumed the leadership of the Sangha after the Buddha's Parinibbana. What is your view of this, especially regards Venerable Ananda's place in the Sangha? Yes, it seems like there's a bit of a coup, doesn't it? I mean, Kassapa's kind of a fairly distant figure for most of the suttas. Ananda's much closer to the Buddha all the time, and then Kassapa kind of sweeps in at the end and takes charge. Quite possibly there was something to that. However, I would be cautious about drawing too much of a conclusion about that, because In my view, the story of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and the First Council and so on has been framed from the perspective of the Second Council. Second Council occurred about 100 years after the Buddha. And it's a connected narrative. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta leads on to the account of the First Council, and the account of the First Council leads on to the account of the Second Council. Now, if you look at what happened in the Second Council was a dispute between two groups of monks, one of whom was more rigorous in their practice of Dhamma, of Vinaya, and one of whom was more relaxed in their practice of Vinaya. Okay? This was the essential problem at the Second Council. It wasn't a dispute about Dhamma, it was a dispute about how strictly should we keep the Vinaya rules. Okay? And the strict group won, okay, at the Second Council. The strict group prevailed, and it's their point of view which I believe that we're seeing the framing that story of the Mahaparinibbana and the First Council. And so they wanted to emphasize Mahakasapa as being the strict monk who was coming along and making sure everything was going to be preserved and all the rules were kept and these kinds of things. So that, again, I'm not trying to say that they invented those stories, and I'm not trying to say that Mahakasapa didn't play that leadership role after the Second Council, after the Buddha passing away, and in the First Council. I'm just suggesting that the manner in which that's presented has been filtered through the eyes and the perspectives of the monks who were the victorious party at the Second Council, and that might explain some of what we're seeing there in the Mahaparinibbana and First Council narrative. So again, I can't go too much into the detail, but that's hopefully given you some idea of how I see that. Dear sir, please let us know how to do metta meditation. Well, you have to come on the weekend. We're doing metta meditation, so please come then and we can do that. Okay. You mentioned that the Buddha did not talk about his life. How the Arya Pariyasana Sutta is a biography of the Buddha. Does this sutta have an equivalent version in Sanskrit and Chinese? Okay, so just to clarify, so I wasn't saying the Buddha didn't talk about his life at all. I was just saying that he didn't talk about it all that much. So yes, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta is an exception to that. And there are a number of other suttas which also are exceptions. So the Buddha did talk about his own life sometimes, but it's just that he didn't talk about it too much. And so there's not really a biography of the Buddha in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. Yes, there's some background and some details about his choices and how he went forth and his practice and so on. So yes, partial biography, but not a complete biography there. Yes, that sutta does have equivalents in both Sanskrit and Chinese. It's a very well-attested sutta, I believe. Off the top of my head, I believe it may also have parallels in Tibetan as well. Certainly the main passages on the Buddha's life have parallels in Tibetan. So those passages, I think, understandably enough, were among the most popular and very widespread throughout the whole of the Buddhist tradition. So those accounts are found well distributed, and again, just trying to recall off the top of my head, but I think the accounts in those are very similar. One detail that is an interesting detail, I'll just mention this in passing, but we know that before the Buddha's enlightenment, he practiced with Alaraka Lama and then with Uddhaka Ramaputta. Okay? That detail is found in all of the accounts of the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, all of the different versions. But there's one, now the practice under those two teachers is described in almost the same terms, okay? But there's one tiny little difference in how that description is, how that practice is described. And that is that under Alaraka Lama, Alaraka Lama invited him to share, to teach their community together. Okay, so the Buddha or the Bodhisattva reached the same attainment as Alaraka Lama had and said, please, let's teach this community together. Okay, the story under Uddhaka Ramaputta is identical in almost every respect, except one detail is different, that Uddhaka said Rama had also attained this state. Okay, and this is, of course, Ramaputta, right? So Rama's son, yeah? He's saying Rama attained this state, you've now attained it, so you should lead this community. Right? In other words, it seems that Uddhaka Ramaputta hadn't actually attained that highest attainment of the Neva Sanya Nasanya, which the Bodhisattva did. So that tiny little detail in the narrative is actually found in the same form, not just in the Pali, but also in the Chinese and Tibetan versions of the same text, right? So even that tiny little details we found are shared across all the different traditions. Okay. Okay, so here we have, looks like a letter. I probably won't read a letter out right now.
Yes, I don't need to see.
Yes.